This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, in just over a week, Fiji will vote in its election, and people are asking, where are the women in political campaigns? Women's rights activist Shamima Ali will join us to tell us what she thinks, and hundreds of human skulls were taken from Pacific burial grounds to Germany in the late 19th century. Now a work is underway to bring them home and find out more about this troubling past.
The skulls that they were collected because they were trying to compare our brain capacity between the Germans and the islanders.
And a film festival celebrating First Nations experience with the environment kicks off in Melbourne. We'll speak to one of the directors featured later in the show. All that and more. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. First, though, the cost of some alcoholic drinks is set to skyrocket in Papua New Guinea due to a newly imposed tax, a 500% increase to the excise tax on certain pre-mixed drinks was announced in PNG's 2023 national budget just last week. But spirits aren't the only things being mixed here. Opinions on the new tax are also divided, as Marion Farr reports.
Lick, lick money, big plus spark. It's a saying heard frequently across Papua New Guinea. It means, for a little money, you can get very drunk, often referring to cheap pre-mixed drinks with high alcohol content.
A lot has changed growing up in Port Moresby in the past, say, 15 years since the introduction of cheap pre-mixed alcohol into the market.
Richard Marion has lived in Port Moresby most of his life, and he says pre-mixed alcohol is to blame for a rise in crime.
I think it's rapidly became popular, especially amongst young unemployed people in the city. They represent a large part of the consumer market. The growth, the popularity was quite exponential.
He's noticed more theft, violence, and general antisocial behaviour, like loud parties and people being a nuisance on the streets.
We're a lot more guarded and apprehensive because a lot of the riffraff about committing petty crime, they're not doing that to feed an empty stomach, if you will. They're just committing petty crime so that they could get the next fix.
For years, disgruntled citizens have been calling for something to be done. And last week, the PNG government announced a dramatic 493% increase in the tax on these types of alcoholic drinks. Kelly Samoff, an economics lecturer from the University of Papua New Guinea, says consumers will feel the pinch.
This is a pretty hefty tax. The prices of these types of alcoholic drinks, they will go up, they will increase.
It's expected to raise an additional 30 million kina for the government next year.
This goes in line with the government's plan to continue growing their revenue base because what we're seeing is that this current government has a plan, right, to reduce their budget deficit by 2027.
The tax will be applied at the point of sale, meaning buyers will bear the brunt. But Mr. Samoff says local producers of alcoholic drinks will also be impacted.
Employees employed in these alcohol industries might be let go. And even one manufacturer stated that they might let go of 2,000 employees. And if that's 2,000 employees let go, then that's 2,000 families, you know, in PNG without a steady income.
Richard Marion believes these companies should take responsibility.
The companies that produce and sell cheap alcohol or pre-mixed alcohol have long enjoyed the revenues and the business from the alcohol sales. However, I don't feel like they have fully attended to the corporate social responsibility to these communities from which they profit from.
It's a sentiment shared by lay resident Ezra Kaipaletti. He also attributes social issues in his city to cheap alcohol.
Incidents like people stabbing each other from knives or causing troubles with other communities, they get themselves into troubles fighting from each other. And those things never end.
But not everyone is in favour of the new tax. Port Moresby local Solomon Korowa believes young people will turn to illegal home-brewed alcohol instead, which can be extremely dangerous to consume.
When they increase the price, they tend to other sources of alcohol like homebrew or drugs. it's going to cause more problems from my point of view.
He also worries that a rise in alcohol prices will impact families.
Especially the fathers, most of them are alcoholics, so if they tend to drink more alcohol and they spend more money on alcohol, then I don't think by the end of the day the family won't have any food to eat. So for me, I don't think it's a good idea.
Mr. Koroa wants to see the government investing more in other strategies.
I think they should increase the police presence in its suburbs. Mostly they should put the concentration into the law and order. That's the only problem here.
While Richard Merrion is in favour of the alcohol tax, he agrees it's only a first step.
I think the efforts should extend from imposing this tax into bolstering current legislation on offences related to alcohol abuse and antisocial behaviour in our communities.
That was Port Moresby resident Richard Merrion, ending Merrion Farr's report. And the PNG treasurer Ian Ling Stuckey has been contacted for comment. We're still waiting his response. Pacific Beat. It's just over a week till Fiji's national election gets underway, and one community leader is asking, where are the women? Shamima Ali is a women's rights activist and head of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre. She says political parties need to have a much stronger focus on women's issues. And Ms. Ali joins us now. Bula Vinaka, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Bula Vinaka, and thank you very much.
And now, Ms. Ali, we've heard that you have some thoughts on the issues facing women and how they're being reflected in the political campaigns. What do you think is missing from the lead up to the elections next week?
Well, a whole lot of things. For example, we have only 52 women out of 343 candidates. That's 15%. Of women have put their hands up. So we have to ask the questions why. And, the Fiji Women's Rights Movement, our sister organization, just released a survey on the perception, a study on leadership, perceptions of study of leadership in Fiji. And, a lot of people, there's some good things that have come out. People think that women should be leaders and so on. But despite all of that, we still don't have political parties which are able to get women on board. And we had always pushed for a quota system, the temporary special measures. And the Guy Constitution that was thrown away by the present government, and they installed it with their own, replaced it with their own, they took that out. It had that because that was during consultations, women wanted that, the temporary special measures. Because people have to start getting used to women in leadership, having women there, and then they start voting them for them. We have to create the critical mass of women so people get used to seeing women as leaders and women performing as leaders and so on. Because women leaders are all over the place. I mean, all the community leaders, all the work in the community is done by women leaders in their homes, their leaders and so on. So, yeah. So for us, that was a big drawback. And we're seeing the results now, 15% of women, how many of them will be able to get in?
I mean, you asked the question, why is there this low percentage of women's representation in politics? Do you have any thoughts on what could be behind it?
Well, we live in a patriarchal society, throughout the, globally as well as nationally, regionally and so on. And that is very difficult to shake. And women sometimes are a bit careful about stepping into those domains. And when we ask women, why don't you want to stand in? Some women have said that she would find it very difficult to work within that. But also, the stigmatization of women, their personal lives and so on, that deters many women. So there has to be a lot of encouragement. Political parties should have gone out and gotten women on board and so on. But that did not happen. And given the patriarchal society, there are also family considerations. Women have said in this study that people have said, the respondents have said that the more support a woman gets in her within her family and friends, the better she would, you know, the more she would be willing to enter the political arena. So, you know, there you have it.
I mean, we're talking about female community leaders, and there are quite a many of them in Fiji, including yourself, Ms. Ali. I mean, you've been an outspoken women's rights activist in Fiji for a number of years. Have you ever thought of throwing in your hat into politics?
Well, you know, looking at how our country's gone the last 16 years and particularly the last 10 years, and, you know, I'm totally dedicated to promoting human rights, rule of law and democracy and, you know, and feminism, women's human rights. So, you know, I have thought about it. I've given it some thought. Then I realized, no, I really cannot. The more I looked at the parties, these parties are very patriarchal. You know, many of them are, you know, sort of talking about a lot of good things they will do. And, you know, and we have to consider those things. And we do know people who have entered the fray. But for me personally, I think I'm better outside of it. And mentoring younger women for the next elections would be my aim in life. So, you know, I would find it very difficult to function within a party that, you know, is patriarchal and so on. And I don't see any party at the moment that is not so. So, you know, so that's that. But, you know, I'm doing political work outside of that. And there are many other women who think like that, too, who would like to go in. And we really, you know, congratulate a big shout out to Sashi Kiran, who has, you know, an NGO leader for over 25 years and has entered the fray. And I'm sure she will do very well.
And considering that, I mean, you know, even your own personal thoughts about entering and joining a political party, for those women who do make that step, who do decide to run in politics, do they find difficulties even within the party, within these institutions, to get support and run their campaign?
We have some very strong women who have gone in, you know, and such as Linda Tambuya, Lenora Rangerengere Tambua, and other women who have gone in, Saini Nambo, and so on. And, you know, and there are other women who have been there, like Rosie Akbar, who was the minister in the present government and has, you know, gone in for it again. So these are the women, you know, these women are able to work through all of that. Or sometimes women, to be able to function and to also want to be there and to make things better, they are able to negotiate the patriarchal highway and they are able to do that, you know. And what we need to do with them is then, so look, we have got deputy party leaders who are women, you know, we've got a vice president who is a woman and so on. So the political parties are trying, but I think they don't know how to. And what happened is that, which has been my lament, is that even though we offered that, please consult with us, we will teach you, you know, gender sensitized political parties and so on, to how to talk about women and women's rights and so on. There's also a lack of knowledge around how to talk about it. And it's also, you know, lacking the political will to learn about it, you know, when you think very patriarchally. And nobody took that up with us. None of the political parties said, yes, okay, let's learn about this. And I've been saying this for 2 years.
What impact? I mean, we're talking about the low amounts of women in politics, 15% running in this campaign. What impact does that have on voters and the issues that's put in front of them?
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, in all my speeches and wherever I can publicly when I'm speaking, and in our community awareness, you know, we are talking about women, you know, ask for what you want, ask them what they can do for you. And, you know, and we can do that. And women are asking, I'm hearing that they are asking, but, you know, there needs to be a more deeper understanding, a deeper analysis of what is happening to women. And this is what political leaders or candidates should be going in with. And this is what they should be talking about. But from all the talks that I have heard and the many, even the manifestos, there's very little mention of women's rights and, you know, what's happening to them. And it's very perfunctory. It's just by the way kind of thing. There is no deeper analysis or, you know, a deeper thinking around policies and things like that.
Mm. So I guess the issues aren't even being put in front to see how they weigh up. I mean, do you think that lack of articulation on women's issues will have an impact on how people vote come next week?
The other thing is also, while we have done the analysis, you know, Fiji has got a very robust gender policy and so on. We have completed with the Ministry for Women and Civil Society and other experts the country gender assessment, the National Action Plan for the Prevention of All Forms of Violence Against Women. These are all in the pipeline. This should have been implemented a long time ago and so on. It's just sitting there waiting for the Solicitor General's office to endorse or approve, or the Attorney General to approve before it can be put into place and so on. So a lot of people don't know about these things. Even political parties don't know about these things, you know. So when I have raised it with some of them, they want to know more about it so they can, you know, rally around it and so on. But it's a bit too late. Women will vote. People will vote, I think what people are voting for at the moment also, you know, Fiji is in dire straits as far as poverty goes, housing, you know, and so on. And with climate change, it's making things worse for people. So, you know, as usual, people would put women again on the back. Some of the women like us, you know, who are in the movement and who are aware of these things, we will vote according to who, you know, according to who talks about human rights, women's rights, and things like that. Of course, we will look at the policies a lot more closely. But for other people, it would be about bread and butter, you know, issues. It'll be about housing. It will be about climate change, the impact on them, and just poverty, addressing the issue of poverty, and that's how people will vote.
Mm. If you are just tuning in to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia, well, we're about a week away, about 9-10 days by my calculation, from Fiji's national election, and there's concern that political parties aren't paying enough attention to women. And we found out there's only 15% of the candidates running are women, and today we're joined by prominent women's rights advocate Shamima Ali. Now, I wanted to ask you about a very particular law that was passed earlier this year by the Fijian government. Now, it meant that voters in Fiji had to register with their name stated on their birth certificate to vote in this election. Now, there was a lot of concern that this would mean that women who were married and may have taken their husband's name might be put at a disadvantage. We've been hearing stories of that on Pacific Beat. Have you heard any of that? Do you believe that's the case?
Well, it is the case. That's what the law says. I can't say much about it because that's still in court. But, I can't give an opinion on it. But I can say what it means for women. So, for example, like my birth certificate, you know, it's, well, we don't know the whys and what fors, but for my name, I have been using Shamima Ali. That's my family name, Ali. But on my birth certificate, I had my first name and my middle names, Shamima Zahan Ara, daughter of so-and-so Ali, and so on. So I had to go and add on the Ali to Shamima Zahan Ara Ali. I had to add that on and then get registered, because otherwise, I would not have been able to vote if I would have kept Ali, because my birth certificate had missed out the Ali, and just, you know, how we usually do the first name and the middle names. So for me, that was easy because I could just go and add on the Ali. But the women who have taken on their husband's names after marriage, and they're registered under their family name on the birth certificates when they were born, when they did not even know their husbands existed. But many women had to go to be able to vote. Otherwise, there were two alternatives. Either go and, you know, change your name, your family name, to your husband's name. And then you don't have to change all the other documents and you can go and register, or you carry on the name there, but you have to change all your documentation, like your passport, your bank account, all the the documentations that we need to be a good citizen of a country and things like that. So, so that would be very, very hard to do. But many women did, some did not do. So if they did not do that, then they would lose out during the election. So seven women stood up and have taken this to court, and we are still awaiting the judgment about 5-6 months later.
Yes, indeed, that high court challenge, which has been stalled, so we're still awaiting an outcome there. But interesting to hear some of the barriers that that change in the law might have put in place for some women.
A lot of women, and a lot of women are very poor, women are the poorest of the poor. So you have, so for them to go and stand outside, the registry and so on and so forth, it's too much with the work that they do at home and all of that, so it becomes, it's quite daunting. So the women that I spoke to, I was with a group of people with disabilities last week and another group the other day. And I was asking, so I was in the rural areas and I was asking, so how many of you are registered? And I did not hear the resounding response that I wanted. So later on, of course, we all had a chat about it. But it's, people will miss out on that. Mm. Women particularly.
And just finally, Ms. Ali, we've been talking about this low representation of women in the election and also what impact that means in terms of the issues and voter impact. You've mentioned quotas as being one solution. Is that the only solution that you see to this problem?
No, that would be a start, but then we have to do the education. We have to have very good women in leadership programs, and this has to be, people have to come to the table and say, how do we get these women in? And we need to work in schools, we need to work everywhere, educating women, building their self-esteem, confidence, and we have to create an enabling environment for women to jump into the fray. Women are doing very well throughout the world, but, and in Fiji also women are doing very well. But these are actually exceptions rather than the rule. And they can do a lot. I mean, I mix around with a lot of women, both in the rural and the islands and in the urban areas. And there is a lot of potential out there, and women will be doing a lot. Women do, research shows they do a lot better, and there is greater, productivity and so on. So, Parliament can be a piece of cake for women, but we have to make them believe it. We have to create the level playing field. We have to create that enabling environment. And men have to come on board and encourage that and encourage women's leadership within the party also.
Yes, we'll see if that happens and also the outcome of the upcoming election there. Shamima Ali, thank you so much for your time this morning on Pacific Beat.
Pleasure. Have a good day.
You too. That was Shamima Ali, women's rights activist and head of the Fiji Women's Crisis Centre, speaking to me there.
Join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When you're younger, you don't really take note of the significance of this ritual until you're much older. Then you realize that you're proud to be part of this ritual.
So join me, Hilda Wayne, for Sisters Let's Talk. Wednesdays at 3:30 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
And now it's time to find out what's making news around the region. And we actually have some breaking news for you here on Pacific Beat. There has been a magnitude 6.7 quake striking off Hihifo in Tonga. This is some breaking news coming through. This was the headline from Reuters. We have Kyle Evans, reporter here, to bring us some more information about this latest earthquake. Can you tell us more, Kyle?
Yeah, so the Samoa Meteorological Service has issued a warning, a tsunami warning for all low-lying areas in the country. And like you said, it comes after that 6.8 magnitude earthquake occurred in the Tonga Islands region, so about 200 kilometres southwest of Samoa. It was issued at about 9 a.m. Samoan time, so about 35 minutes ago. And at the moment, people are being urged to stay away from all beach areas and to refrain from visiting any coastal areas until a cancellation has been issued.
Yes. And just to clarify, so I understand that it was struck off Tonga, but obviously it's affected quite a few areas. And yes, there's been a tsunami advisory for American Samoa and, as you said, Samoa as well, it seems. We'll continue to monitor this and bring you the latest there. There have been a few earthquake warnings and earthquakes happening and tsunami warnings, issued in the region in recent times. And obviously with that very devastating tsunami and earthquake earlier this year in January in Tonga, I'm sure a lot of people there are quite concerned. So please, everyone, do contact your local emergency services if you can. There is that warning out for the surrounding areas around Tonga's Hihifo Island. So, yes, please listen to your authorities to find out what to do, and we'll bring you the latest here on Pacific Beat, ABC Radio Australia as well. Now, let's head to Vanuatu, where, well, there's been a relocation suggestion. Plans are being drawn up to relocate dozens of villages over the next 2 years. I imagine it's to do with climate change. Why is that?
That's right. So the climate change minister, Ralph Reganvanu, who's been on this show before, he says dozens of villages are coming under threat from rising sea levels. And as a result, many of their inhabitants will have to be moved away from the coast. It's unfortunate. Not only are rising sea levels due to climate change, but it's also fueling a lot more severe storms as well. So as a result, the government has identified dozens of settlements that will need to be moved in the next 24 months, and other settlements have been earmarked to be moved further down the track.
Yes, and this comes, we've heard a lot of, considerations of this. Fiji is relocating dozens of villages because of this, because of rising sea levels. And, of course, we've got other low-lying countries like Tuvalu, even considering going online, going into the metaverse to deal with rising sea levels there. It is a problem facing a lot of countries, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things he's also called for is better coastal defences strengthened, so better infrastructure, things like that. That might mean more sandbagging or seawalling or whatever that might be. Apparently, it's 25 to 58 centimetres is how much seas are expected to rise over the next by the middle of the decade, which is pretty concerning. And given 60% of the population live within a kilometre of the coast, and Vanuatu in particular is quite vulnerable to things like cyclones, flooding and volcanoes, it's no surprise that they're cracking the whips.
Yes, and that is Climate Change Minister Ralph Reganvanu making those comments there. Yes, interesting stuff. And I believe that story was reported by Agence France-Presse. You can head online to their website to find out more on that. This to the Solomon Islands. They're celebrating post-COVID tourism figures despite a massive drop in visitation. Is that right?
Yeah, a bit of an interesting one. So Tourism Solomons have released their quarterly figures for July and September. So it's really the first major sample data the country's had since they reopened their borders back in July. And 2,481 international visitors came through the gates in the Solomons for that period. However, it represented a drop of almost 68%, given, pre-pandemic, they usually average about 29,000 visitors per year. So, but given the drop, they actually do think it's a pretty promising start, given they literally started from zero when the borders reopened.
Yes, indeed. Though I imagine that a lot of people are concerned and waiting for their, regular salaries and incomes to come back, particularly those in the tourism sector. Do we know where most of these recent tourists that have contributed to a bit of an uptick have come from?
Yeah, so no surprisingly, Australians have made up the bulk of the numbers. So 1,038 Aussies visited the country during that three-month period, making up about 41% of that total intake. Take-up, however, has been much slower from some of those other key markets like the US, New Zealand, PNG and Fiji.
Interesting. Well, I wonder if the Pacific Games is coming up next year. I wonder if that'll change things there in Solomon Islands. Is it Solomon Islands? Yes, that's what we're talking about. I suddenly got a bit brain dead, to be honest.
Monday morning.
It is Monday morning. Kyle, thank you for those stories making news around the region today.
Not a problem.
That was Kyle Evans. And just to remind you that we did have some breaking news there about a tsunami warning being issued after an earthquake struck off Hihifo in Tonga. There's been tsunami warnings for Samoa, American Samoa, and areas around Tonga, we believe. We'll try and bring you the latest here on Pacific Beat on that. We do have a couple of other stories coming up as well. We have a story about skulls and human remains being returned from universities in Germany back to the Pacific. It's part of a restitution project there. We'll find out why coming up on this show. And we'll also be speaking to a film director as part of a new film festival here in Melbourne.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
And yes, let's head to Germany now, where thousands of human remains taken from the Pacific decades ago are on their way home thanks to a restitution project headed by the University of Göttingen. Many of the skulls and skeletons held by the university were used in race research, an outdated practice widely condemned for its bigotry and racism. And some Pacific communities are only just finding out that their ancestors were removed from burial sites. When you enter the collection rooms of the anthropology department in the University of Göttingen, you're greeted by looming white shelves stacked tall with cardboard boxes. It looks like your regular storage room, pretty unremarkable. But inside these boxes are reminders of a dark and troubling moment in Germany's scientific past.
Our ancestral remains are in Göttingen.
McMichael Mutok Jr. works as a history preservation specialist and registrar for the Palau government. He visited the university to see what was inside these boxes. At least 10 of them contain skulls taken from his islands in the Pacific and shipped to Germany more than 100 years ago.
They had these markings, numbers that's written on the skulls, each of the skulls. And the Göttingen University has the list of index cards that would identify as Palau. And there were actually like 10 of them that were in the collections. But there were 12 index cards. So it means there were two missing.
Not much was known about the skulls, where exactly they came from, or how they all got to Europe from Palau. Mr. Mutok Jr. is part of a team of cultural representatives, researchers and historians trying to find answers and get those human remains back home. In their investigations, they've made some shocking discoveries.
So I actually find out like a lot of our ancestor remains were collected by the South Seas Expedition. When we traveled to the Hamburg Archive, they had a lot of journals from the South Seas Expeditions. Paul Hamburg went to this one village and he actually asked the villagers that he needed a couple of skulls. And then the villagers, they actually refused. So he went there by himself and took a couple of them without knowledge of our villagers, yeah.
That lack of knowledge meant that until Mr. Mutok Jr. was contacted by the university in Germany, he and many Palauans didn't even know the skulls were stolen and taken abroad.
So it's actually pretty sad that we didn't know about it until now.
And there were more surprises in store.
What I learned is the skulls that they were collected because they were trying to compare our brain capacity between the Germans and the islanders to see how like intelligence are are we? I would say like the Germans way back 100 years, they're kind of like racist, trying to compare us. How different are we?
The German collectors didn't just take skulls from Palau. There are thousands of human remains from countries including Papua New Guinea, Kiribati, French Polynesia, Australia and New Zealand, stored in just two collections by the University of Göttingen.
The context of this human remains is very, very varied.
Jonathan Kurtzwelly is a social anthropologist researching the university's Sensitive Provenances project to return the human remains.
It has been networks of missionaries, of early explorers and so on, who have kind of been requested to deliver human remains, often initially at great reluctance, and have ultimately sent these human remains to the early scientists of the Enlightenment, who then established comparative anatomy and often quite explicitly wanted to do what today is described as race science, as a kind of rather invalid discipline.
He says the project is part of a renewed focus by Germany's museums and universities to recognize their sometimes disturbing colonial pasts.
Germany has been very strong in kind of reworking through the history of the Second World War and of the Holocaust, most of all. So that's a lot of work that has been done in terms of historical memory, memorialization, and so on. But Germany only recently woke up to its colonial history. Germany is at the moment at a level in which many institutions proactively say, well, we realize we have a collection that we really haven't looked for 50 years at, and maybe we should do something with it, and maybe it's problematic to keep having it.
Some ancestral remains have already been returned. Earlier this year in Hawaii, 13 skeletal remains called iwi kupuna were returned to their descendants in a ceremonial event. Cultural practitioner Kaleahu Kakeres spoke at the event.
We are recognizing our kupuna again, and they are recognizing us in return. Having their leadership severed from our lives for several generations has caused many of us to lose our way, to lose ourselves. Reconnection to our ancestral family helps us to find our way again. We are welcoming our kupuna back into our lives and homes to continue to guide us, to inspire us, to protect us.
Professor Regina Bendix from the University of Göttingen also spoke.
We recognize the need to apologize in the name of our forebears for holding your ancestors for so long unburied in cartons and closets.
But for many other Pacific communities, the journey to bring home their ancestors' skeletons has only just started. Fijian archaeologist Dr. Teresi Vunadillo is a fellow at the University of Göttingen.
For me as a researcher, alongside my fellow researchers from Africa and Oceania, it's quite an emotional journey because a lot of us look at these human remains just like, their family. And, when you see them traded like, a piece of wood or, any other item, it's quite moving.
She says it's a difficult process to find the families and return their ancestral remains.
So some have information, which is really good. So we can actually track it back straight to the tribe. Majority, unfortunately, are not clear or unknown. So what we're doing is we're learning from examples like in Hawaii and New Zealand and Australia. When there are unknown locations or unknown sources, that's when the museums step in. So in some countries, they do kind of a combined burial or a memorial that is created where all of these human remains that were unidentified, even though the main point is to take them back to where they originally come from, but for those that don't have information, that may be the pathway that we will follow. The things are changing. It's shifting from museums being gatekeepers or stopping Indigenous people from accessing these collections to now inviting people from Indigenous communities to actually come along and research about their own people. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Back in Palau, McMichael Matok Jr. is also glad to be part of the project, but he says it will be at least a year for his country's ancestors to return home.
We're trying to collect more, as much information as we can. And hopefully there would be a DNA testing to know where our human ancestors like came from, which village or which clans in Palau. But for me, I feel like there's still more out there. there's still more work to do.
That was McMichael Mutok Jr., who's the registrar from the government of Palau, ending that report. Very interesting stuff there. If you do want to get in touch, if you have more information about that story, about the return of human remains to the Pacific, do get in touch with us. We're at ABC Pacific. You can find us on online on all your social media sites, or you can email us as well, ABC Pacific or Pacific at abc.net.au. And now, we had that breaking news early in the show about an earthquake and tsunami alert being issued. We understand the American Samoa tsunami advisory has cancelled that tsunami warning there. But to find out more about exactly what's going on, we have Don Blakeman, USGS National Earthquake Information Center. He's a geophysicist there. Good morning to you, Don.
Good morning.
So what do we know? We've heard there has been an earthquake and subsequent tsunami warning there in Tonga, Samoa, American Samoa and surrounding areas. Can you tell us the latest?
Yeah, what has occurred is a magnitude 6.7 earthquake. And although there might have been a little bit of local wave activity, there was no Pacific-wide tsunami warning issued on this.
Okay, so things are looking good then, so this is not a big concern to you?
No, we can't. You can never really tell exactly what will happen. I have to see, you know, contact people who live on those islands and so forth and see if they've had any effects. But as far as earthquake shaking and so forth, it's probably far enough away from populated centers that it wouldn't have done any major damage. But again, that's just based on what we usually see with a quake like this in this type of location.
And where exactly did this quake take place?
Well, it's south-southwest of Samoa, basically. It took place under the sea floor, so it's not really close to any of the islands.
Oh, okay, so good news there. A 6.7, I understand, is the magnitude. Is that quite high when it comes to these underwater, undersea eruptions?
Not really. I mean, the larger a quake is, the fewer of them occur, and this is just a global thing. Fortunately, we don't have very many large quakes compared to the number of small quakes that occur all the time. But this area around Tonga is very seismically active, so this is not an unusual quake at all.
Okay, well, this is good news then. Is this good news that, I guess, the warning systems did go out? We understand there was a warning there in Samoa. Is everything working as it should be?
Yes, everything went just the way it should, and we always, of course, get information very quickly on these earthquakes, and we get the information out there within 20 minutes at the latest. And so this is the way the system is designed, and it worked well.
And are there any concerns as far as aftershocks go, or do we see that most of the activity has finished?
Well, we really can't tell what quakes will come because we're not able to predict earthquakes. No one is. But just based on how these large, shallow quakes happen and what we typically see in these series, there will likely be some aftershocks. But we can't tell exactly when or how large they'll be. But the nature of these aftershock series are that if there are aftershocks, they will be, you know, it's kind of by definition, they will be smaller. And as time goes by, there will be fewer and they will be smaller and smaller. They kind of taper off.
Okay, well, that is good news. So it seems like this quake, we're hoping, hasn't hit many populations or any, if even, and that there'll be very few impacts from this latest quake there off the coast of Samoa. Is that right?
Well, I hope that that's true. All we can do is make our best estimate of what might have happened. And at this point, I don't see any major damage, but just have to wait and see with these things once reports start coming in. from Samoa.
Yes, yes. And Don, I mean, you work at the USGS National Earthquake Information Center. What's the work process like after you get information about these quakes? What happens next?
Well, any new data that comes in, we'll just include with the solution of this quake, and we refine the depth and the location. And then if there are reports of any sort of damage or people having felt it, and I'm certain that, I mean, this quake has already been felt in Samoa, we know that. Mm. As that information comes in, we just include it and update for a better report on the quake.
Okay, and yes, and we will bring you the update here on ABC Radio Australia as well as they come in. So good news, it sounds like. I guess a lot of people are on edge after January's big volcanic eruption, at least, and the tsunami right. warnings issued there. Is that what you're finding as well, Don, in your work?
Well, sure. Anytime a large natural event happens, like the eruption or a large earthquake, of course, people will be very nervous about this, and they shouldn't be overly concerned, but should just be aware of the situation they're in, and you know what to do if another earthquake occurs.
Now we do broadcast to Samoa and Tonga and their surrounding areas. Do you have any words of advice? We understand the immediate threat has gone. Some of the tsunami advisories or warnings have been taken back. Any advice for those listening in those countries?
Just that if there are aftershocks, just know to, you know, if you're outside, stay outside. If you're in a building and can quickly get outside, that's the thing to do. But if you're in a large building, say in one of the capitals or something, then it's best to just stay inside and get under a doorway or a table, you know, in case anything might fall down.
Yes, important advice there. Don, thank you for jumping on the line so early. Well, I don't know where you are, but I hope it's a more reasonable time than this where we are in Melbourne. Thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Sure, you're welcome.
That was Don Blakeman. He's a geophysicist from the USGS National Earthquake Information Center. We were talking about that recent earthquake and tsunami alert put out for a quake that struck off the coast of Samoa, we understand. It was felt in Samoa, at least. But as we just heard by Don, the immediate fears and concerns around the strength of that eruption or that quake has subsided. But do keep aware of any aftershocks and listen to your local emergency authorities for any updates. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. A reminder that there was a magnitude 6.7 quake that struck in the area of Tonga, Samoa, and American Samoa. We understand that tsunami warnings were issued, but that has since been downgraded. The Tsunami Advisory Board in American Samoa have retracted that tsunami warning. Do get in touch with your local authorities for any more information.